and 14 together in the bottom row as an indication of the year in which he accomplished this incredible feat. Catherine scanned the numbers, amazed by all the combinations. Langdon's tone grew more excited now. Extraordinarily, Melancholia I represents the very first time in history that a magic square appeared in European art. Some historians believe this was Dürer's encoded way of indicating that the ancient mysteries had traveled outside the Egyptian mystery schools and were now held by the European secret societies. Langdon paused. Which brings us back to this. He motioned to the slip of paper bearing the grid of letters from the stone pyramid. I assume the layout looks familiar now? Langdon asked.
4x4 square.
Langdon picked up the pencil and carefully transcribed Dürer's numbered magic square onto the slip of paper, directly beside the lettered square. Catherine was now seeing just how easy this was going to be. He stood poised, pencil in hand, and yet, strangely, after all this enthusiasm, he seemed to hesitate.
Robert?
He turned to her, his expression one of trepidation. Are you sure we want to do this? Peter expressly,
Robert, if you don't want to decipher this engraving, then I will.
She held out her hand for the pencil. Langdon could tell there would be no deterring her, and so he acquiesced, turning his attention back to the pyramid. Carefully, he superimposed the magic square over the pyramid's grid of letters, and assigned each letter a number. Then he created a new grid, placing the Masonic cipher's letters in the new order as defined by the sequence in Dürer's magic square. When Langdon was finished, they both examined the result. Catherine immediately felt confused.
It's still gibberish.
Langdon remained silent a long moment. Actually, Catherine, it's not gibberish. His eyes brightened again with the thrill of discovery. It's Latin. In a long, dark corridor, an old blind man shuffled as quickly as he could toward his office. When he finally arrived, he collapsed in his desk chair, his old bones grateful for the reprieve. His answering machine was beeping. He pressed the button and listened.
It's Warren Bellamy, said the hushed whisper of his friend and Masonic brother. I'm afraid I have alarming news.
Catherine Solomon's eyes shot back to the grid of letters, re-examining the text. Sure enough, a Latin word now materialized before her eyes.
Jehovah.
Catherine had not studied Latin, but this word was familiar from her reading of ancient Hebrew texts. Jehovah. Jehovah. As her eyes continued to trace downward, reading the grid like a book, she was surprised to realize she could read the entire text of the pyramid. Jehovah Sanctus Unus. She knew its meaning at once. This phrase was ubiquitous in modern translations of Hebrew scripture. In the Torah, the God of the Hebrews was known by many names, Jehovah, Jehovah, Yeshua, Yahweh, the Source, the Elohim. But many Roman translations had consolidated the confusing nomenclature into a single Latin phrase, Jehovah Sanctus Unus.
One true God?
She whispered to herself. The phrase certainly did not seem like something that would help them find her brother.
That's this pyramid's secret message? One true God? I thought this was a map.
Langdon looked equally perplexed, the excitement in his eyes evaporating. This decryption obviously is correct, but...
The man who has my brother wants to know a location.
She tucked her hair behind her ear.
This is not going to make him very happy.
Catherine, Langdon said, heaving a sigh, I've been afraid of this. All night I've had a feeling we're treating as reality a collection of myths and allegories. Maybe this inscription is pointing to a metaphorical location, telling us that the true potential of man can be accessed only through the one true God.
But that makes no sense, Catherine replied, her jaw now clenched in frustration. My family protected this pyramid for generations. One true God? That's the secret? And the CIA considers this an issue of national security? Either they're lying, or we're missing something.
Langdon shrugged in accord. Just then, his phone began to ring. In a cluttered office lined with old books, the old man hunched over his desk, clutching a phone receiver in his arthritic hand. The line rang and rang. At last, a tentative voice answered.
Hello? The voice was deep but uncertain. The old man whispered,
I was told you require sanctuary.
The man on the line seemed startled. Who is this? Did Warren Bell—
No names, please,
the old man said.
Tell me, have you successfully protected the map that was entrusted to you?
A startled pause. Yes, but I don't think it matters. It doesn't say much. If it is a map, it seems to be more metaphorical than—
No, the map is quite real, I assure you, and it points to a very real location. You must keep it safe. I cannot impress upon you enough how important this is. You are being pursued, but if you can travel unseen to my location, I will provide sanctuary. And answers.
The man hesitated, apparently uncertain.
My friend,
the old man began, choosing his words carefully.
There is a refuge in Rome, north of the Tiber, which contains 10 stones from Mount Sinai, one from heaven itself, and one with the visage of Luke's dark father. Do you know my location?
There was a long pause on the line, and then the man replied, Yes, I do. The old man smiled.
I thought you might, Professor. Come at once. Make sure you're not followed.
Chapter 71 Malach stood naked in the billowing warmth of his steam shower. He felt pure again, having washed off the last remaining scent of ethanol. As the eucalyptus-infused vapors permeated his skin, he could feel his pores opening to the heat. Then he began his ritual. First, he rubbed depilatory chemicals across his tattooed body and scalp, removing any traces of body hair. Hairless were the gods of the 7 islands of Heliades. Then he massaged abramelin oil into his softened and receptive flesh. Abramelin is the sacred oil of the great magi. Then he turned his shower lever hard to the left, and the water turned ice cold. He stood beneath the frigid water for a full minute, to close his pores and trap the heat and energy within his core. The cold served as a reminder of the icy river in which this transformation had begun. When he stepped from the shower, he was shivering, but within seconds his core heat emanated up through his layers of flesh and warmed him. Malach's insides felt like a furnace. He stood naked before the mirror and admired his form. Perhaps the last time he would see himself as a mere mortal. His feet were the talons of a hawk. His legs, Boaz and Jachin, were the ancient pillars of wisdom. His hips and abdomen were the archways of mystical power. Hanging beneath the archway, his massive sex organ bore the tattooed symbols of his destiny. In another life, this heavy shaft of flesh had been his source of carnal pleasure. But no longer. I have been purified. Like the mystical eunuch monks of Catheroi, Malach had removed his testicles. He had sacrificed his physical potency for a more worthy one. Gods have no gender. Having shed the human imperfection of gender along with the earthly pull of sexual temptation, Malach had become like Uranus, Attis, Sporus, and the great castrati magicians of Arthurian legend. Every spiritual metamorphosis is preceded by a physical one. Such was the lesson of all the great gods, from Osiris to Tammuz to Jesus to Shiva to the Buddha himself. I must shed the man who clothes me. Abruptly, Malach drew his gaze upward past the double-headed phoenix on his chest, past the collage of ancient sigils adorning his face, and directly to the top of his head. He tipped his head toward the mirror, barely able to see the circle of bare flesh that waited there. This location on the body was sacred. Known as the fontanelle, it was the one area of the human skull that remained open at birth. An oculus to the brain. Although this physiological portal closes within a matter of months, it remains a symbolic vestige of the lost connection between the outer and inner worlds. Malach studied the sacred patch of virginal skin, which was enclosed by the crown-like circle of an Ouroboros, a mystical snake, devouring its own tail. The bare flesh seemed to stare back at him, bright with promise.
Robert Langdon soon would uncover the great treasure that Malak required. Once Malak possessed it, the void on top of his head would be filled, and he would at last be prepared for his final transformation. Malak padded across his bedroom and took from his bottom drawer a long strip of white silk. As he had done many times before, he wrapped it around his groin and buttocks. Then he went downstairs. In his office, his computer had received an email message. It was from his contact. "What you require is now within reach. I will contact you within the hour. Patience." Malak smiled. It was time to make final preparations. Chapter 72. The CIA field agent was in a foul mood as he descended from the reading room balcony. "Bellamy lied to us. The agent had seen no heat signatures whatsoever upstairs near the Moses statue, nor anywhere else upstairs for that matter. So where the hell did Langdon go?" The agent retraced his steps now to the only place they'd spotted any heat signatures at all, the library's distribution hub. He descended the stairs again, moving beneath the octagonal console. The noise of the rumbling conveyors was grating. Advancing into the space, he flipped down his thermal goggles and scanned the room. Nothing. He looked toward the stacks where the mangled door still showed hot from the explosion. Other than that, he saw no... Holy shit! The agent jumped back as an unexpected luminescence drifted into his field of vision. Like a pair of ghosts, the dimly glowing imprints of two humanoids had just emerged from the wall on a conveyor belt. Heat signatures. Stunned, the agent watched as the two apparitions circled the room on the conveyor loop and then disappeared headfirst into a narrow hole in the wall. They rode the conveyor out? That's insanity. In addition to realizing they had just lost Robert Langdon through a hole in the wall, the field agent was now aware that he had another problem. Langdon's not alone? He was just about to switch on his transceiver and call the team leader, but the team leader beat him to it. "All points. We've got an abandoned Volvo on the plaza in front of the library, registered to one Catherine Solomon. Eyewitness says she entered the library not long ago. We suspect she's with Robert Langdon. Director Sato has ordered that we find them both immediately." "I've got heat signatures for both of them," shouted the field agent in the distribution room. He explained the situation.
"For Christ's sake,"
the team leader replied.
"Where the hell does the conveyor go?"
The field agent was already consulting the employee reference schematic on the bulletin board.
"Adams Building," he replied. "One block from here."
"All points. Redirect to the Adams Building. Now!"
Chapter 73. Sanctuary. Answers. The words echoed in Langdon's mind as he and Catherine burst through a side door of the Adams Building and out into the cold winter night. The mysterious caller had conveyed his location cryptically, but Langdon had understood. Catherine's reaction to their destination had been surprisingly sanguine. Where better to find one true God? Now the question was how to get there. Langdon spun in place, trying to get his bearings. It was dark, but thankfully the weather had cleared. They were standing in a small courtyard. In the distance, the Capitol Dome looked startlingly far away, and Langdon realized this was the first moment he had stepped outside since arriving at the Capitol several hours ago. So much for my lecture.
"Robert, look."
Catherine pointed toward the silhouette of the Jefferson Building. Langdon's first reaction on seeing the building was astonishment that they had traveled so far underground on a conveyor belt. His second reaction, however, was alarm. The Jefferson Building was now abuzz with activity. Trucks and cars pulling in, men shouting. "Is that a searchlight?" Langdon grabbed Catherine's hand.
"Come on."
They ran northeast across the courtyard, quickly disappearing from view behind an elegant U-shaped building, which Langdon realized was the Folger Shakespeare Library. This particular building seemed appropriate camouflage for them tonight, as it housed the original Latin manuscript of Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, the utopian vision on which the American forefathers had allegedly modeled a new world based on ancient knowledge. Even so, Langdon would not be stopping.
"We need a cab."
They arrived at the corner of 3rd Street and East Capitol. The traffic was sparse, and Langdon felt fading hope as he scanned for taxis. He and Catherine hurried northward on 3rd Street, putting distance between themselves and the Library of Congress. It was not until they had gone an entire block that Langdon finally spotted a cab rounding the corner. He flagged it down, and the cab pulled over. Middle Eastern music played on his radio, and the young Arab driver gave them a friendly smile.
"Where to?"
the driver asked as they jumped into the car.
"We need to go to
Northwest," Catherine interjected, pointing up 3rd Street away from the Jefferson Building.
"Drive toward Union Station, then left on Massachusetts Avenue. We'll tell you when to stop."
The driver shrugged, closed the plexiglass divider, and turned his music back on. Catherine shot Langdon an admonishing look, as if to say, "Leave no trail." She pointed out the window, directing Langdon's attention to a black helicopter that was skimming in low, approaching the area.
Shit.
Sato was apparently dead serious about recovering Solomon's pyramid. As they watched the helicopter land between the Jefferson and Adams buildings, Catherine turned to him, looking increasingly worried.
"Can I see your cell phone for a second?"
Langdon handed her his phone.
"Peter told me you have an eidetic memory," she said, rolling down her window, "and that you remember every phone number you've ever dialed."
"That's true, but..." Catherine hurled his phone out into the night. Langdon spun in his seat and watched as his cell phone cartwheeled and splintered into pieces on the pavement behind them.
"Why did you do that?"
"Off the grid," Catherine said, her eyes grave. "This pyramid is our only hope of finding my brother, and I have no intention of letting the CIA steal it from us."
In the front seat, Omar Amirana bobbed his head and hummed along with his music. Tonight had been slow, and he felt blessed to finally have a fare. His cab was just passing Stanton Park when the familiar voice of his company dispatcher crackled over the radio.
"This is dispatch. All vehicles in the area of the National Mall. We have just received a bulletin from government authorities regarding 2 fugitives in the area of the Adams Building."
Omar listened in amazement as dispatch described the precise couple in his cab. He stole an uneasy glance in his rearview mirror. Omar had to admit, the tall guy did look familiar somehow. Did I see him on America's Most Wanted? Gingerly, Omar reached for his radio handset.
"Dispatch," he said, speaking quietly into the transceiver. "This is cab 134. The 2 people you asked about. They are in my cab, right now."
Dispatch immediately advised Omar what to do. Omar's hands were trembling as he called the phone number dispatch had given him. The voice that answered was tight and efficient, like that of a soldier.
"This is Agent Turner Simpkins, CIA Field Ops. Who is this?"
I'm the taxi driver," Omar said. "I was told to call about the 2...
"Are the fugitives currently in your vehicle? Answer only yes or no."
"Yes."
"Can they hear this conversation? Yes or no?"
"No, the slider is..."
"Where are you taking them?"
"Northwest on Massachusetts."
"Specific destination?"
"They didn't say."
The agent hesitated.
"Is the male passenger carrying a leather bag?"
Omar glanced in the rearview mirror, and his eyes went wide.
"Yes, that bag doesn't have explosives or anything in..."
"Listen carefully," the agent said. "You are in no danger so long as you follow my directions exactly. Is that clear?"
"Yes, sir."
"What is your name?"
"Omar," he said, breaking a sweat.
"Listen, Omar," the man said calmly. "You're doing great. I want you to drive as slowly as possible while I get my team out in front of you. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"Also, is your cab equipped with an intercom system so you can communicate with them in the back seat?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. Here's what I want you to do."
Chapter 74. The jungle, as it is known, is the centerpiece of the U.S. Botanic Garden, USBG, America's living museum, located adjacent to the U.S. Capitol building. Technically a rainforest, the jungle is housed in a towering greenhouse, complete with soaring rubber trees, strangler figs, and a canopy catwalk for more daring tourists. Normally, Warren Bellamy felt nurtured by the jungle's earthy smells and the sunlight glinting through the mist that filtered down from the vapor nozzles in the glass ceiling. Tonight, however, lit only by moonlight, the jungle terrified him. He was sweating profusely, writhing against the cramps that now stabbed at his arms, still pinned painfully behind him. Director Sato paced before him, puffing calmly on her cigarette, the equivalent of eco-terrorism in this carefully calibrated environment. Her face looked almost demonic in the smoke-filled moonlight that streamed down through the glass ceiling overhead.
"So then," Sato continued, "when you arrived at the capital tonight, and you discovered that I was already there, you made a decision. Rather than making your presence known to me, you descended quietly into the SBB, where, at great risk to yourself, you attacked Chief Anderson and myself, and you helped Langdon escape with the pyramid and capstone."
She rubbed her shoulder.
"An interesting choice."
"A choice I would make again," Bellamy thought.
"Where is Peter?"
he demanded angrily.
"How would I know?"
Sato said.
"You seem to know everything else,"
Bellamy fired back at her, making no attempt to hide his suspicion that she was somehow behind all this.
"You knew to go to the Capitol building, you knew to find Robert Langdon, and you even knew to X-ray Langdon's bag to find the capstone. Obviously someone is giving you a lot of inside information."
Sato laughed coldly and stepped closer to him.
"Mr. Bellamy, is that why you attacked me? Do you think I'm the enemy? Do you think I'm trying to steal your little pyramid?"
Sato took a drag on her cigarette and blew the smoke out of her nostrils.
"Listen carefully. No one understands better than I do the importance of keeping secrets. I believe, as you do, that there is certain information to which the masses should not be privy. Tonight, however, there are forces at work that I fear you have not yet grasped. The man who kidnapped Peter Solomon holds enormous power, a power that you apparently have yet to realize. Believe me, he is a walking time bomb, capable of initiating a series of events that will profoundly change the world as you know it."
"I don't understand."
Bellamy shifted on the bench, his arms aching in his handcuffs.
"You don't need to understand. You need to obey. Right now, my only hope of averting a major disaster is to cooperate with this man, and to give him exactly what he wants. Which means you are going to call Mr. Langdon and tell him to turn himself in, along with the pyramid and capstone. Once Langdon is in my custody, he will decrypt the pyramid's inscription, obtain whatever information this man is demanding, and provide him with exactly what he wants."
"The location of the spiral staircase that leads to the ancient mysteries?"
"I can't do that. I've taken vows of secrecy."
Sato erupted.
"I don't give a damn what you've vowed. I will throw you in prison so fast."
"Threaten me all you like," Bellamy said defiantly. "I will not help you."
Sato took a deep breath and spoke now in a fearsome whisper.
"Mr. Bellamy, you have no idea what's really going on tonight, do you?"
The tense silence hung for several seconds, finally broken by the sound of Sato's phone. She plunged her hand into her pocket and eagerly snatched it out.
"Talk to me,"
she answered, listening carefully to the reply.
"Where is their taxi now? How long? Okay, good. Bring them to the U.S. Botanic Garden, service entrance, and make sure you get me that goddamn pyramid and capstone."
Sato hung up and turned back to Bellamy with a smug smile.
"Well then, it seems you're fast outliving your usefulness."
Chapter 75. Robert Langdon stared blankly into space, feeling too tired to urge the slow-moving taxi driver to pick up the pace. Beside him, Catherine had fallen silent too, looking frustrated by their lack of understanding of what made the pyramid so special. They had again been through everything they knew about the pyramid, the capstone, and the evening's strange events. They still had no ideas as to how this pyramid could possibly be considered a map to anything at all. Jehovah Sanctus Unus? The secret hides within the Order? Their mysterious contact had promised them answers if they could meet him at a specific place. A refuge in Rome, north of the Tiber. Langdon knew the forefathers, New Rome, had been renamed Washington early in her history, and yet vestiges of their original dream remained. The Tiber's waters still flowed into the Potomac. Senators still convened beneath a replica of St. Peter's Dome, and Vulcan and Minerva still watched over the rotunda's long-extinguished flame. The answers sought by Langdon and Catherine were apparently waiting for them just a few miles ahead, northwest on Massachusetts Avenue. Their destination was indeed a refuge, north of Washington's Tiber Creek. Langdon wished the driver would speed up. Abruptly, Catherine jolted upright in her seat, as if she had made a sudden realization.
"Oh, my God, Robert!"
She turned to him, her face going white. She hesitated a moment, and then spoke emphatically.
"We're going the wrong way."
"No, this is right," Langdon countered. "It's northwest on Massachusetts—"
"No, I mean we're going to the wrong place."
Langdon was mystified. He had already told Catherine how he knew what location was being described by the mysterious caller. "It contains 10 stones from Mount Sinai, one from heaven itself, and one with the visage of Luke's dark father. Only one building on earth could make those claims, and that was exactly where this taxi was headed. Catherine, I'm certain the location is correct."
"No," she shouted. "We don't need to go there anymore. I figured out the pyramid and capstone. I know what this is all about."
Langdon was amazed. "You understand it?"
"Yes. We have to go to Freedom Plaza instead."
Now Langdon was lost. Freedom Plaza, although nearby, seemed totally irrelevant.
"Jehovah Sanctus Unus," Catherine said. "The one true God of the Hebrews. The sacred symbol of the Hebrews is the Jewish star, the seal of Solomon, an important symbol to the Masons."
She fished a dollar bill out of her pocket.
"Give me your pen."
Bewildered, Langdon pulled a pen from his jacket.
"Look."
She spread the bill out on her thigh and took his pen, pointing to the great seal on the back.
"If you superimpose Solomon's seal on the great seal of the United States..."
She drew the symbol of a Jewish star, precisely over the pyramid.
"Look at what you get."
Langdon looked down at the bill, and then back at Catherine as if she were mad.
"Robert, look more closely. Don't you see what I'm pointing at?"
He glanced back at the drawing. What in the world is she getting at? Langdon had seen this image before. It was popular among conspiracy theorists as proof that the Masons held secret influence over our early nation. When the 6-pointed star was laid perfectly over the Great Seal of the United States, the star's top vertex fit perfectly over the Masonic all-seeing eye, and, quite eerily, the other 5 vertices clearly pointed to the letters M-A-S-O-N. "Catherine, that's just a coincidence, and I still don't see how it has anything to do with Freedom Plaza."
"Look again," she said, sounding almost angry now. "You're not looking where I am pointing. Right there. Don't you see it?"
An instant later, Langdon saw it. CIA field operations leader Turner Simpkins stood outside the Adams building and pressed his cell phone tightly to his ear, straining to hear the conversation now taking place in the back of the taxi. Something just happened. His team was about to board the modified Sikorsky UH-60 helicopter to head northwest and set up a roadblock, but now it seemed the situation had suddenly changed. Seconds ago, Catherine Solomon had suddenly begun insisting they were going to the wrong destination. Her explanation, something about the dollar bill and Jewish stars, made no sense to the team leader, nor apparently to Robert Langdon, at least at first. Now, however, Langdon seemed to have grasped her meaning.
"My God, you're right," Langdon blurted. "I didn't see it earlier."
Suddenly Simpkins could hear someone banging on the driver's divider, and then it slid open.
"Change of plans," Catherine shouted to the driver. "Take us to Freedom Plaza."
"Freedom Plaza?"
the cabbie said, sounding nervous.
"Not northwest on Massachusetts?" "Forget that," Catherine shouted. "Freedom Plaza, go left here, here, here."
Agent Simpkins heard the cab screeching around a corner. Catherine was talking excitedly again to Langdon, saying something about the famous bronze cast of the Great Seal embedded in the plaza.
"Ma'am, just to confirm,"
the cabbie's voice interjected, sounding tense.
"We're going to Freedom Plaza, on the corner of Pennsylvania and 13th?
"Yes," Catherine said. "Hurry!"
It's very close. 2 minutes.
Simpkins smiled. Nicely done, Omar. As he dashed toward the idling helicopter, he shouted to his team,
We've got them. Freedom Plaza, move!
Chapter 76 Freedom Plaza is a map. Located at the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and 13th Street, the plaza's vast surface of inlaid stone depicts the streets of Washington as they were originally envisioned by Pierre L'Enfant. The plaza is a popular tourist destination not only because the giant map is fun to walk on, but also because Martin Luther King Jr., for whom Freedom Plaza is named, wrote much of his I Have a Dream speech in the nearby Willard Hotel. D.C. cab driver Omar Amirana brought tourists to Freedom Plaza all the time. But tonight, his two passengers were obviously no ordinary sightseers.
The CIA is chasing them?
Omar had barely come to a stop at the curb before the man and woman had jumped out.
Stay right here, the man in the tweed coat told Omar. We'll be right back.
Omar watched the two people dash out onto the wide open spaces of the enormous map, pointing and shouting as they scanned the geometry of intersecting streets. Omar grabbed his cell phone off the dashboard.
Sir, are you still there?
Yes, Omar,
a voice shouted, barely audible over a thundering noise on his end of the line.
Where are they now?
Out on the map. It seems like they're looking for something.
Do not let them out of your sight, the agent shouted. I'm almost there.
Omar watched as the two fugitives quickly found the plaza's famous Great Seal, one of the largest bronze medallions ever cast. They stood over it a moment and quickly began pointing to the southwest. Then the man in tweed came racing back toward the cab. Omar quickly set his phone down on the dashboard as the man arrived, breathless.
Which direction is Alexandria, Virginia? He demanded.
Alexandria?
Omar pointed southwest, the exact same direction the man and woman had just pointed toward.
I knew it,
the man whispered beneath his breath. He spun and shouted back to the woman.
You're right! Alexandria!
The woman now pointed across the plaza to an illuminated metro sign nearby.
The blue line goes directly there. We want King Street Station.
Omar felt a surge of panic.
Oh, no.
The man turned back to Omar and handed him entirely too many bills for the fare.
Thanks. We're all set.
He hoisted his leather bag and ran off.
Wait, I can drive you. I go there all the time.
But it was too late. The man and woman were already dashing across the plaza. They disappeared down the stairs into the Metro Center subway station. Omar grabbed his cell phone.
Sir, they ran down into the subway. I couldn't stop them. They're taking the blue line to Alexandria.
Stay right there, the agent shouted. I'll be there in 15 seconds.
Omar looked down at the wad of bills the man had given him. The bill on top was apparently the one they had been writing on. It had a Jewish star on top of the Great Seal of the United States. Sure enough, the star's points fell on letters that spelled Mason. Without warning, Omar felt a deafening vibration all around him, as if a tractor trailer were about to collide with his cab. He looked up, but the street was deserted. The noise increased, and suddenly a sleek black helicopter dropped down out of the night and landed hard in the middle of the plaza map. A group of black-clad men jumped out. Most ran toward the subway station, but one came dashing toward Omar's cab. He yanked open the passenger door.
Omar, is that you?
Omar nodded, speechless.
Did they say where they were headed? The agent demanded.
Alexandria, King Street Station, Omar blurted. I offered to drive, but...
Did they say where in Alexandria they were going?
No. They looked at the medallion of the Great Seal on the plaza. Then they asked about Alexandria, and they paid me with this.
He handed the agent the dollar bill with the bizarre diagram. As the agent studied the bill, Omar suddenly put it all together.
The Masons. Alexandria.
One of the most famous Masonic buildings in America was in Alexandria.
That's it, he blurted. The George Washington Masonic Memorial. It's directly across from King Street Station.
That it is,
the agent said, apparently having just come to the same realization as the rest of the agents came sprinting back from the station.
We missed them, one of the men yelled. Blue line just left. They're not down there.
Agent Simpkins checked his watch and turned back to Omar.
How long does the subway take to Alexandria?
10 minutes at least, probably more.
Omar, you've done an excellent job. Thank you.
Sure. What's this all about?
But Agent Simpkins was already running back to the chopper, shouting as he went.
King Street Station! We'll get there before they do.
Bewildered, Omar watched the great black bird lift off. It banked hard to the south across Pennsylvania Avenue, and then thundered off into the night. Underneath the cabbie's feet, a subway train was picking up speed as it headed away from Freedom Plaza. On board, Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon sat breathless. Neither one saying a word, as the train whisked them toward their destination. Chapter 77. The memory always began the same way. He was falling, plummeting backward toward an ice-covered river at the bottom of a deep ravine. Above him, the merciless gray eyes of Peter Solomon stared down over the barrel of Andras's handgun. As he fell, the world above him receded, everything disappearing as he was enveloped by the cloud of billowing mist from the waterfall upstream. For an instant, everything was white, like heaven. Then he hit the ice. Cold. Black. Pain. He was tumbling, being dragged by a powerful force that pounded him relentlessly across rocks in an impossibly cold void. His lungs ached for air, and yet his chest muscles had contracted so violently in the cold that he was unable even to inhale.
I'm under the ice.
The ice near the waterfall was apparently thin on account of the turbulent water, and Andros had broken directly through it. Now he was being washed downstream, trapped beneath a transparent ceiling. He clawed at the underside of the ice, trying to break out. But he had no leverage. The searing pain from the bullet hole in his shoulder was evaporating, as was the sting of the birdshot. Both were blotted out now by the crippling throb of his body going numb. The current was accelerating, slingshotting him around a bend in the river. His body screamed for oxygen. Suddenly he was tangled in branches, lodged against a tree that had fallen into the water.
Think!
He groped wildly at the branch, working his way toward the surface, finding the spot where the branch pierced up through the ice. His fingertips found the tiny space of open water surrounding the branch, and he pulled at the edges, trying to break the hole wider. Once, twice, the opening was growing, now several inches across. Propping himself against the branch, he tipped his head back and pressed his mouth against the small opening. The winter air that poured into his lungs felt warm. The sudden burst of oxygen fueled his hope. He planted his feet on the tree trunk and pressed his back and shoulders forcefully upward. The ice around the fallen tree, perforated by branches and debris, was weakened already, and as he drove his powerful legs into the trunk, his head and shoulders broke through the ice, crashing up into the winter night. Air poured into his lungs. Still mostly submerged, he wriggled desperately upward, pushing with his legs, pulling with his arms, until finally he was out of the water, lying breathless on the bare ice. Andros tore off his soaked ski mask and pocketed it, glancing back upstream for Peter Solomon. The bend in the river obscured his view. His chest was burning again. Quietly, he dragged a small branch over the hole in the ice in order to hide it. The hole would be frozen again by morning. As Andros staggered into the woods, it began to snow. He had no idea how far he had run when he stumbled out of the woods onto an embankment beside a small highway. He was delirious and hypothermic. The snow was falling harder now, and a single set of headlights approached in the distance. Andros waved wildly, and the lone pickup truck immediately pulled over. It had Vermont plates. An old man in a red plaid shirt jumped out. Andros staggered toward him, holding his bleeding chest.
A hunter shot me. I need a hospital.
Without hesitation, the old man helped Andros up into the passenger seat of the truck and turned up the heater.
Where's the nearest hospital?
Andros had no idea, but he pointed south.
Next exit.
We're not going to a hospital.
The old man from Vermont was reported missing the next day, but nobody had any idea where on his journey from Vermont he might have disappeared in the blinding snowstorm. Nor did anyone link his disappearance to the other news story that dominated the headlines the next day. the shocking murder of Isabel Solomon. When Andros awoke, he was lying in a desolate bedroom of a cheap motel that had been boarded up for the season. He recalled breaking in and binding his wounds with torn bedsheets, and then burrowing into a flimsy bed beneath a pile of musty blankets. He was famished. He limped to the bathroom and saw the pile of bloody birdshot pellets in the sink. He vaguely recalled prying them out of his chest. Raising his eyes to the dirty mirror, he reluctantly unwrapped his bloody bandages to survey the damage. The hard muscles of his chest and abdomen had stopped the birdshot from penetrating too deep. And yet his body, once perfect, was now ruined with wounds. The single bullet fired by Peter Solomon had apparently gone cleanly through his shoulder, leaving a bloody crater. Making matters worse, Andros had failed to obtain that for which he had traveled all this distance. The pyramid. His stomach growled and he limped outside to the man's truck, hoping maybe to find food. The pickup was now covered with heavy snow, and Andros wondered how long he had been sleeping in this old motel. Thank God I woke up. Andros found no food anywhere in the front seat, but he did find some arthritis painkillers in the glove compartment. He took a handful, washing them down with several mouthfuls of snow.
I need food.
A few hours later, the pickup that pulled out from behind the old motel looked nothing like the truck that had pulled in 2 days earlier. The cab cap was missing, as were the hubcaps, bumper stickers, and all of the trim. The Vermont plates were gone, replaced by those from an old maintenance truck Andros had found parked by the motel dumpster, into which he had thrown all the bloody sheets, birdshot, and other evidence that he had ever been at the motel. Andros had not given up on the pyramid, but for the moment it would have to wait. He needed to hide, heal, and above all eat. He found a roadside diner where he gorged himself on eggs, bacon, hash browns, and 3 glasses of orange juice. When he was done, he ordered more food to go. Back on the road, Andros listened to the truck's old radio. He had not seen a television or newspaper since his ordeal, and when he finally heard a local news station, the report stunned him. FBI investigators, a news announcer said, continue their search for the armed intruder who murdered Isabel Solomon in her Potomac home 2 days ago. The murderer is believed to have fallen through the ice and been washed out to sea. Andros froze. Murdered Isabel Solomon? He drove on in bewildered silence, listening to the full report. It was time to get far, far away from this place. The Upper West Side apartment offered breathtaking views of Central Park. Andros had chosen it because the sea of green outside his window reminded him of his lost view of the Adriatic. Although he knew he should be happy to be alive, he was not. The emptiness had never left him, and he found himself fixated on his failed attempt to steal Peter Solomon's pyramid. Andros had spent long hours researching the legend of the Masonic pyramid, and although nobody seemed to agree on whether or not the pyramid was real, they all concurred on its famous promise of vast wisdom and power.
The Masonic pyramid is real, Andros told himself. My inside information is irrefutable.
Fate had placed the pyramid within Andros's reach, and he knew that ignoring it was like holding a winning lottery ticket and never cashing it in.
I am the only non-Mason alive who knows the pyramid is real, as well as the identity of the man who guards it.
Months had passed, and although his body had healed, Andros was no longer the cocky specimen he had been in Greece. He had stopped working out, and he had stopped admiring himself naked in the mirror. He felt as if his body were beginning to show signs of age. His once perfect skin was a patchwork of scars, and this only depressed him further. He still relied on the painkillers that had nursed him through his recovery, and he felt himself slipping back to the lifestyle that had put him in Saganluk prison. He didn't care. The body craves what the body craves. One night he was in Greenwich Village buying drugs from a man whose forearm had been tattooed with a long, jagged lightning bolt. Andros asked him about it, and the man told him the tattoo was covering a long scar he had gotten in a car accident. Seeing the scar every day reminded me of the accident, the dealer said, and so I tattooed over it with a symbol of personal power. I took back control. That night, high on his new stash of drugs, Andros staggered into a local tattoo parlor and took off his shirt.
I want to hide these scars, he announced.
I want to take back control.
Hide them?
The tattoo artist eyed his chest. With what?
Tattoos.
Yes, I mean tattoos of what?
Andros shrugged, wanting nothing more than to hide the ugly reminders of his past.
I don't know. You choose.
The artist shook his head and handed Andros a pamphlet on the ancient and sacred tradition of tattooing. Come back when you're ready. Andros discovered that the New York Public Library had in its collection 53 books on tattooing, and within a few weeks he had read them all. Having rediscovered his passion for reading, he began carrying entire backpacks of books back and forth between the library and his apartment, where he voraciously devoured them while overlooking Central Park. These books on tattoos had opened a door to a strange world Andros had never known existed, a world of symbols, mysticism, mythology, and the magical arts. The more he read, the more he realized how blind he had been. He began keeping notebooks of his ideas, his sketches, and his strange dreams. When he could no longer find what he wanted at the library, he paid rare book dealers to purchase for him some of the most esoteric texts on earth. De Prestigiis Demonum, Le Megaton, Ars Amadel, Grimorium Verum, Ars Notoria, and on and on. He read them all, becoming more and more certain that the world still had many treasures yet to offer him.
There are secrets out there that transcend human understanding.
Then he discovered the writings of Aleister Crowley, a visionary mystic from the early 1900s, whom the church had deemed the most evil man who ever lived.
Great minds are always feared by lesser minds.
Andros learned about the power of ritual and incantation. He learned that sacred words, if properly spoken, functioned like keys that opened gateways to other worlds.
There is a shadow universe beyond this one, a world from which I can draw power.
And although Andros longed to harness that power, he knew there were rules and tasks to be completed beforehand.
Become something holy, Crowley wrote. Make yourself sacred.
The ancient rite of sacred making had once been the law of the land. From the early Hebrews who made burnt offerings at the temple, to the Mayans who beheaded humans atop the pyramids of Chichen Itza, to Jesus Christ, who offered his body on the cross, the ancients understood God's requirement for sacrifice. Sacrifice was the original ritual by which humans drew favor from the gods and made themselves holy. Sacra, sacred, face, make. Even though the rite of sacrifice had been abandoned eons ago, its power remained. There had been a handful of modern mystics, including Aleister Crowley, who practiced the art, perfecting it over time, and transforming themselves gradually into something more. Andros craved to transform himself as they had, and yet he knew he would have to cross a dangerous bridge to do so.
Blood is all that separates the light from the dark.
One night, a crow flew through Andros's open bathroom window and got trapped in his apartment. Andros watched the bird flutter around for a while, and then finally stop, apparently accepting its inability to escape. Andros had learned enough to recognize a sign.
I am being urged onward.
Clutching the bird in one hand, he stood at the makeshift altar in his kitchen and raised a sharp knife, speaking aloud the incantation he had memorized.
Kamiach, Eomachi, Emiar, Machbar, Emoi, Zazian. By the most holy names of the angels in the book of Asamayan, I conjure thee that thou assist me in this operation by the power of the one true God.
Andros now lowered the knife and carefully pierced the large vein on the right wing of the panicked bird. The crow began to bleed. As he watched the stream of red liquid flowing down into the metal cup he had placed as a receptacle, he felt an unexpected chill in the air. Nonetheless, he continued.
Almighty Adonai, Aratron, Ashai, Elohim, Elohai, Elion, Asherechai, Shaddai. Be my aid, so that this blood may have power and efficacy in all wherein I shall wish, and in all that I shall demand.
That night, he dreamed of birds, of a giant phoenix rising from a billowing fire. The next morning, he awoke with an energy he had not felt since childhood. He went running in the park, faster and farther than he'd imagined possible. When he could run no longer, he stopped to do push-ups and sit-ups. Countless repetitions. Still he had energy. That night, again, he dreamed of the phoenix. Autumn had fallen again on Central Park, and the wildlife were scurrying about searching for food for winter. Andros despised the cold, and yet his carefully hidden traps were now overflowing with live rats and squirrels. He took them home in his backpack, performing rituals of increasing complexity.
Immanuel, Mashiach, Yod, He, Vod, please find me worthy.
The blood rituals fueled his vitality. Andros felt younger every day. He continued to read day and night, ancient mystical texts, epic medieval poems, the early philosophers. And the more he learned about the true nature of things, the more he realized that all hope for mankind was lost. They are blind, wandering aimlessly in a world they will never understand. Andros was still a man, but he sensed he was evolving into something else, something greater, something sacred. His massive physique had emerged from dormancy, more powerful now than ever before. He finally understood its true purpose. My body is but a vessel for my most potent treasure, my mind. Andros knew his true potential had not yet been realized, and he delved deeper. What is my destiny? All the ancient texts spoke of good and evil, and of man's need to choose between them. I made my choice long ago, he knew, and yet he felt no remorse. What is evil, if not a natural law? Darkness followed light. Chaos followed order. Entropy was fundamental. Everything decayed. The perfectly ordered crystal eventually turned into random particles of dust. There are those who create, and those who destroy. It was not until Andros read John Milton's Paradise Lost that he saw his destiny materialize before him. He read of the great fallen angel, the warrior demon who fought against the light, the valiant one, the angel called Moloch. Moloch walked the earth as a god. The angel's name, Andros later learned, when translated to the ancient tongue, became Malach. And so shall I. Like all great transformations, this one had to begin with a sacrifice. But not of rats, nor birds. No, this transformation required a true sacrifice. There is but one worthy sacrifice. Suddenly, he had a sense of clarity unlike anything he had ever experienced in his life. His entire destiny had materialized. For 3 straight days, he sketched on an enormous sheet of paper. When he was done, he had created a blueprint of what he would become. He hung the life-size sketch on his wall and gazed into it as if into a mirror. I am a masterpiece. The next day, he took his drawing to the tattoo parlor. He was ready. Chapter 78. The George Washington Masonic Memorial stands atop Shooter's Hill in Alexandria, Virginia. Built in 3 distinct tiers of increasing architectural complexity from bottom to top, Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, the structure stands as a physical symbol of man's intellectual ascent. Inspired by the ancient Pharos Lighthouse of Alexandria, Egypt, this soaring tower is capped by an Egyptian pyramid with a flame-like finial. Inside the spectacular marble foyer sits a massive bronze of George Washington in full Masonic regalia, along with the actual trowel he used to lay the cornerstone of the Capitol building. Above the foyer, 9 different levels bear names like the Grotto, the Crypt Room, and the Knights Templar Chapel. Among the treasures housed within these spaces are over 20,000 volumes of Masonic writings, a dazzling replica of the Ark of the Covenant, and even a scale model of the throne room in King Solomon's temple. CIA agent Simpkins checked his watch as the modified UH-60 chopper skimmed in low over the Potomac. 6 minutes until their train arrives. He exhaled and gazed out the window at the shining Masonic memorial on the horizon. He had to admit, the brilliantly shining tower was as impressive as any building on the National Mall. Simpkins had never been inside the memorial, and tonight would be no different. If all went according to plan, Robert Langdon and Catherine Solomon would never make it out of the subway station.
"Over there!" Simpkins shouted to the pilot, pointing down at the King Street subway station across from the memorial.
The pilot banked the helicopter and set it down on a grassy area at the foot of Shooter's Hill. Pedestrians looked up in surprise as Simpkins and his team piled out, dashed across the street, and ran down into King Street Station. In the stairwell, several departing passengers leaped out of the way, plastering themselves to the walls as the phalanx of armed men in black thundered past them. The King Street Station was larger than Simpkins had anticipated, apparently serving several different lines, blue, yellow, and Amtrak. He raced over to the metro map on the wall, found Freedom Plaza and the direct line to this location.
"Blue line, southbound platform," Simpkins shouted. "Get down there and clear everyone out."
His team dashed off. Simpkins rushed over to the ticket booth, flashed his identification, and shouted to the woman inside.
"The next train from Metro Center. What time is it due?"
The woman inside looked frightened.
"I'm not sure. Blue line arrives every 11 minutes. There's no set schedule."
"How long since the last train?"
5-6 minutes, maybe? No more than that."
Turner did the math. Perfect. The next train had to be Langdon's. Inside a fast-moving subway car, Catherine Solomon shifted uncomfortably on the hard plastic seat. The bright fluorescent lights overhead hurt her eyes, and she fought the impulse to let her eyelids close, even for a second. Langdon sat beside her in the empty car, staring blankly down at the leather bag at his feet. His eyelids looked heavy, too, as if the rhythmic sway of the moving car were lulling him into a trance. Catherine pictured the strange contents of Langdon's bag.
Why does the CIA want this pyramid?
Bellamy had said that Sato might be pursuing the pyramid because she knew its true potential. But even if this pyramid somehow did reveal the hiding place of ancient secrets, Catherine found it hard to believe that its promise of primeval mystical wisdom would interest the CIA. Then again, she reminded herself, the CIA had been caught several times running parapsychological or PSI programs that bordered on ancient magic and mysticism. In 1995, the Stargate Scan-8 scandal had exposed a classified CIA technology called remote viewing, a kind of telepathic mind travel that enabled a viewer to transport his mind's eye to any location on Earth and spy there, without being physically present. Of course, the technology was nothing new. Mystics called it astral projection, and yogis called it out-of-body experience. Unfortunately, horrified American taxpayers called it absurd, and the program had been scuttled, at least publicly. Ironically, Catherine saw remarkable connections between the CIA's failed programs and her own breakthroughs in noetic science. Catherine felt eager to call the police and find out if they had discovered anything in Kalorama Heights, but she and Langdon were phoneless now, and making contact with the authorities would probably be a mistake anyway. There was no telling how far Sato's reach extended.
Patience, Catherine.
Within minutes, they would be in a safe hiding place, guests of a man who had assured them he could provide answers. Catherine hoped his answers, whatever they might be, would help her save her brother.
"Robert,"
she whispered, glancing up at the subway map.
"Next stop is ours."
Langdon emerged slowly from his daydream.
"Right, thanks."
As the train rumbled toward the station, he collected his day bag and gave Catherine an uncertain glance.
"Let's just hope our arrival is uneventful."
By the time Turner Simpkins dashed down to join his men, the subway platform had been entirely cleared, and his team was fanning out, taking up positions behind the support pillars that ran the length of the platform. A distant rumble echoed in the tunnel at the other end of the platform, and as it grew louder, Simpkins felt the stale push of warm air billowing around him.
"No escape, Mr. Langdon."
Simpkins turned to the two agents he had told to join him on the platform.
"Identification and weapons out. These trains are automated.
but they all have a conductor who opens the doors. Find him.